If you would please turn in your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Ecclesiastes chapter 9. I wanted to take, as I mentioned last time, a couple weeks to kind of set the tone for this year and just thinking biblically about life, having the right perspective through the difficult things that kind of our world is involved in currently and the difficult things that may lie ahead. So I just wanted to think through that perspective, and the texts that I landed on were Ecclesiastes 8, 14 through 17, which we looked at last time, and then we're going to look at Ecclesiastes 9, 1 through 9 this morning. I'm going to begin by reading this text for us. Solomon says, "For I have taken all this into my heart and explain it, that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. Man does not know whether it will be love or hatred. Anything awaits him. It is the same for all. There is one fate for the righteous and for the wicked, for the good, for the clean, for the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice, and for the one who does not sacrifice. As the good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that there is one fate for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead. For whoever joined with all the living, there is hope. Surely a live dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead do not know anything, nor have they any longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten. Indeed, their love, their hate, and their zeal have already perished, and they will no longer have a share in all that is done under the sun. Go then, eat your bread in happiness, and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approve your works. Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun, for this is your reward in life and in your toil in which you have labored under the sun." J.L. Dagg, in his Manual of Systematic Theology, which was the first systematic theology written by a Baptist in America in the mid-19th century, wrote this helpful statement concerning the wisdom of God, which I believe guides us back into our study into Ecclesiastes this morning. It says this, "It should fill us with joy that infinite wisdom guides the affairs of the world. Many of its events are shrouded in darkness and mystery, and inextricable confusion sometimes seems to reign. Often wickedness prevails, and God seems to have forgotten the creatures that he has made. Our own path through life is dark and devious and beset with difficulties and dangers. How full of consolation is the doctrine that infinite wisdom directs every event, brings order out of confusion, and light out of darkness, and to those who love God, causes all things, whatever be their present aspect and apparent tendency, to work together for good." God's wisdom is central to the text that we will study this morning, and it is critical for us to embrace as we live life in this fallen world. Enjoying life and embracing God's wisdom in the midst of uncertainty are, I believe, worthwhile goals to pursue as we enter this new year. Well, as we get back into our study, I want to remind you regarding where we ended last time. If you recall, verses 16 and 17 of chapter 8 function, as I said, as a transition or a hinge into the next section of this book. And verse 1 of chapter 9 is connected to the end of chapter 8, functioning as part of that hinge as well. Last time in verses 14 through 17 of chapter 8, we studied two faithful responses to the fallenness that encompasses us in this world. And that second response that we looked at was to trust God's infinite wisdom over human limited wisdom. To trust God's infinite wisdom over human limited wisdom. In that point, Solomon taught us that God's wisdom infinitely outweighs our human wisdom, and that his wisdom in dealing with all of the issues of this life is impossible to be fully known. It's impossible for us to fully understand, as God's wisdom is infinite and we are finite creatures. And he said in verse 17 of chapter 8 that though he searched to know the working of God in this world to the point of countless sleepless nights, he concluded that it was impossible to achieve that end. Well, verse 1 of our text this morning continues in that vein to again clarify for us the reality of God's sovereign providence and our need as his children to submit to that reality. That word "for" there at the beginning of verse 1 in chapter 9 connects us to the previous section grammatically. Look again at verse 1. He says, "For I have taken all this to my heart and explain it, that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. Man does not know whether it will be love or hatred. Anything awaits him." The statement here at the beginning of verse 16 is very similar to the statement at the beginning, verse 1, is very similar to the beginning of verse 16. If you look back at verse 16 of chapter 8, he says, "When I gave my heart to know wisdom." Here he says, "I have taken all this into my heart." The "all this" includes, as one author put it, the whole gamut of human existence and earthly life. Solomon applied all of himself. That is what's meant by the word heart here. All of himself, his intellect, his emotion, his experiences, to examining life's paradoxes. Things such as the one we encountered last time, which is evil being rewarded and righteousness being punished. And though he and we are unable to fully understand the workings of God, verse 1 brings us comfort in the midst of sovereign providence that the righteous and the wise are in the hands of God. You see, God knows those who are his children and those who belong to him. And he takes care of them according to his sovereign plan for their life to bring himself glory and to bring about their ultimate good. Never forget that. Never forget that. Though we are too living in the midst of life's greatest paradox, evil being rewarded, righteousness being punished, that we are in the hands of God. Don't lose sight of that in the midst of experiencing difficulty in this fallen world, because that's easy to do. However, it's crucial for us to understand that although we, as his children, are in his hands, that doesn't exclude the righteous from difficulty and from suffering. And that's expressed by that term hatred there at the end of verse 1. So man does not know whether it will be love or hatred. Friends, we are not to draw unintended theological conclusions when we are experiencing either good or difficulty from the hand of God. Remember Job. Job is a fascinating book. As this most righteous man at that point in history, he was the most righteous man who had ever lived, was confronted by Satan under God's orders to test him, to take away everything that was good in his life, because he wasn't only the most righteous man, he was also the richest man. You could say he was the one who had the best life ever. And Satan tested him and took away everything, including much of his family. Only his wife remained, and she didn't have very good advice. And he had friends. Friends that I think were well-intentioned, but gave also bad advice because they did this. They drew unintended theological conclusions when Job was experiencing the difficulty in his life. All of his friends' conclusions were related to the fact, they all had different nuances, but they were all related to the fact that Job somehow sinned. Job had somehow sinned so grievously against God that God took away everything in his life. Even by the end of the book, Job had struggled to understand what was happening, and Job even confronted God in the latter chapters of the book. And then we see God speak, and God sets Job in his proper place, and Job realizes that he also had drawn unintended theological conclusions in experiencing this difficulty in his life. It was for the purposes of God. It was to magnify God. It was for Job to trust in God. It had nothing to do with sin that Job had committed. It was all under the purposes of God. And so it's very important for us to understand, and what Solomon is reiterating here, even in verse 1, is that yes, all of us are in the hands of God, and yes, all of us are going to experience good, and all of us are going to experience evil. But as we experience those things in life, it is very important for us not to somehow draw unintended theological conclusions and thus think wrongly about God. So how then do we practically trust in the wisdom of God when uncertainty is constantly lurking at the door? Because again, we don't, as Solomon said last time, and as he reiterated here in verse 1, we don't know what God is doing ultimately. I mean, we know he's working everything out for his glory and his good. We know that he has an ultimate will that he is fulfilling. But in the ebb and flow of life, and all of the good and the bad, we don't really know. And so how do we practically embrace the wisdom of God in the midst of that uncertainty? Well, we have to faithfully act upon what we do know. We have to faithfully act upon what we do know. We have to take what God has revealed to us about himself, ourselves, and this life, and then we have to orient our lives, that is how we think, how we speak, and how we act, in accordance with what he has revealed in his word. We must extract the wisdom we are to glean from the knowledge that we have received, and from that we make direct application into our lives. And so, in our text this morning, I want you to note two pertinent applications of trusting in God's wisdom. Two pertinent applications of trusting in God's wisdom. And the first pertinent application is this. It is to embrace what he has specifically revealed to you. Embrace what he has specifically revealed to you, and find that in verses 2 through 6. Throughout this book, when laying out the reality of life on a fallen planet, Solomon often begins the specific revelation that we are to understand and embrace with that which is more negative, with that which is more the discouraging side of life. But regardless of its morbid nature, when this revelation is embraced, friends, understand this, that it is life-changing for the believer. The first thing that we see that he has specifically revealed in verses 2 through 3 is this: death is inevitable. Death is inevitable. Friends, it is good for us to ponder at times the stark reality of death. It is good for us to ponder that reality. I've said it from here before. I have talked to many of you about this. But I like funerals often more than I like weddings. Now, I loved the wedding I was a part of this weekend, and I love weddings. I love everything about weddings. But I love funerals more, and I know that's a weird thing to say. Because funerals cause you to recalibrate your thinking about life every single time. It doesn't matter if you're intimately acquainted with the human who just passed away. You might go to a funeral that you have some loose connection to who you really never knew. But if you sit there and the pastor does his job, you will have to recalibrate your thinking regarding life and regarding what matters. In fact, in Ecclesiastes 7, just a couple chapters before here, Solomon says this in verse 2. He says, "It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man. And the living," what does the living do? "Takes it to heart." It is good at times to ponder the stark reality of death. Look at verse 2 in our text. It says, "It is the same for all. There is one fate for the righteous and for the wicked, for the good and for the clean and for the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice, for the one who doesn't, for the one who does not sacrifice." Says, "The good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. That is an evil that is done under the sun, that there is one fate for all men." Every single person who ever walks on this earth will face death. Because death is no respecter of persons. There is no one who slips out from under the fate of death. People of our world don't live like that. Sometimes we forget that. But one day, every human being who is left will die, and we will understand that every human being that has ever lived has died. Because that is the curse of living in a fallen world. That was part of the curse that God placed on humanity because of Adam and Eve's sin in the Garden of Eden. And you see that clearly in the first statement of verse 2. Solomon says, it is the same for all. Physical death is the consequence of the fall for all living creatures, including every human person. To drill down on his point here, Solomon gives five contrasts of groups of people to explain that death is certain and inevitable. We just read them. These categories of people are there in verse 2, the righteous, in contrast with the wicked, the good and the clean, in the contrast with the unclean, the one who offers sacrifice versus the one who doesn't offer sacrifice, the good person, the sinner, the one who vows and the one who doesn't vow. There's different options regarding that last phrase, the one who vows, the one who doesn't vow. There's different interpretive options on that. I like the second option. I think it's the likely option. It's the one who vows allegiance to God's covenant versus the one who doesn't. I think that's what Solomon is saying there. This second option follows the parallel style that Solomon is laying out in these categories with the good and then the bad. But regardless, the point that Solomon is bringing to the table here is that death is an evil that awaits everyone. In verse 3, Solomon identifies that this one fate for all men, death, he identifies it as evil. You say, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun. And it is evil, and it is because of evil that death happens. You see, death only exists because of our rebellion. This was not part of what God called good in Genesis 1 and 2. He never called the fall good. He never called sin good. He never called evil good. And as you continue down in verse 3, you see the stark reality of death causes people to go insane as they seek to gratify their flesh fully. Look there in the middle of verse 3. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterward, they go to the dead. That is the end result. Solomon says with absolute clarity that regardless of the insanity that men live with on this planet, and that insanity involves all the things they do in which they are trying to maybe gain more life, gain more time, Solomon says with absolute clarity, the end of their life is death. But not only has God revealed clearly that death is inevitable, he has also specifically revealed that death is hopeless. Death is hopeless. Look at verse 4. For whoever is joined with all the living, there's hope. Surely a live dog is better than a dead lion. Note the comparison that Solomon makes here. It's actually quite shocking. So a live dog is better than a dead lion. And this comparison is shocking because of how both of these animals were perceived by the Jews in this day, by this culture. Dogs were despised. Quick story. Crazy. This wedding I was a part of, Dylan and Emma on Friday night. You know, we were there. I was standing up front. The people were coming down fast. They were flying down that aisle. And they were lining all up. And out of the corner of my eye, I see this creature. Because it was a chapel, but the backside where I was at had no back. There was a pond, and there was grass. And I was standing there, and I just saw this creature just flash. So, you know, they were coming fast enough. People were pretty focused on them. I decided to get eyes on what was going on back there. And so I just looked around. There was this tiny little dog, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. Hope that guy doesn't come in here. Well, over the course of the ceremony, a herd of dogs gathered. A herd. I don't even know if that's what you call dogs. A herd, a pack, a group. But they gathered. And peripherally, I could see different things happening. And you guys know Emma. She's a wonderful girl. Very jovial. I told people as she left, the most jovial bride I've ever seen while I was marrying them. And so she was laughing the whole ceremony, just at the joy of the wedding day, the things that I tell brides to do. I wondered if I was about to get bit by a dog. And so that was going through my mind this whole time. There was a couple faux pas because I was concerned about the dogs. And so all that to say is just as dogs were despised in this day, I do despise dogs as well. Not just because of that incident, but I do not like them. In that day, as they were on Friday, they were a dime a dozen. They were all around. And they wandered around Israel like scavengers. And they were deemed by these Jews as extremely unclean, to the point where they thought of them as better dead than alive by many people. Lions, on the other hand, were perceived as mighty and majestic. And you might even say respected in some sense by the Jewish people. They were thought of much better as alive rather than dead. So what Solomon does in this statement is he hammers home the point he is after with the stark use of this metaphor, saying this: life is better than death. That is what he's driving home in this verse. We are given this one life on this earth. We are not going to come back as another person or a plant or a grasshopper or anything. Reincarnation is not biblical. So we are given this one life. And as Solomon is driving that home, he is saying death is hopeless because it ends this one life that we have. The ending of that life is hopeless. This reality screams at us the point of this book, which is this life that you have been given as a gift of God is to be lived to the fullest. Again, that's something that he is continuing to buffer as he goes throughout this book. But notice how those who are alive have hope. Hope in what? Verse 5 says, for the living know that they will die, but the dead do not know anything, for they no longer have a reward, for the memory is forgotten. You see, those who are alive live with the hope of preparing to meet God. The hope of making a significant contribution to his kingdom, and the hope of living with meaning and purpose. That is the hope that we have as we live, as we breathe, as we go throughout our days. But death, Solomon says, ends that hope. Friend, if you're here and you're not in Christ, you need to hear that resounding in your mind. That you have one life. And what you do with this life matters. How you respond to the God who created you matters. Because when your life ends, it's not just the hopelessness that Solomon is talking about in the sense that you no longer live on this earth, but it is an infinite hopelessness that you will embrace as you are separated from God for all of eternity in hell. And so it's important to understand that here. You need Christ to have any hope at all. And it's not just some vague hope that Christ provides. All of us sitting in here who love Christ and who know Christ know that the hope that Christ provides is better than anything else in the world. It is the most prized thing. That one day we will be with the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords for all of eternity. In a perfect body, rejoicing around the throne, serving all the days of our life, loving the people of God, all of those whom God has saved throughout the centuries, forever and ever. No sin to get in the way. No physical illness or limitations to have to compete with. But that's the hope that we have because of Christ. It is the greatest hope there ever was and ever will be. But if you are sitting here without Christ, you know nothing of that, and your hopelessness is an infinite hopelessness. Well, furthermore, in verses 5 and 6, we see a third reality that God has specifically revealed to us, and that is this: death is sorrowful. Death is sorrowful. Verse 5, for the living know that they will die, but the dead do not know anything, nor have they any longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten. Indeed, their love, their hate, their zeal have already perished, and they will no longer have a share in all that is done under the sun. Solomon makes clear in these verses what we understand without a doubt experientially, and that is this: that death is sorrowful. Death is sad. There's weeping, there's mourning. Oftentimes there's anger when somebody dies. And death was never meant to be a happy reality. Why is this? It's because of what verse 5 says, that those who are alive at least can think and process the prospect of death, while on the flip side, those who are dead know nothing. Nothing. Because they're gone. They are no longer thinking about anything. That body that lays in the casket that is without a soul knows nothing anymore. Is no longer processing anything in their thoughts. They're gone. Along with that, the dead no longer have reward in this life. All of the wonderful rewards in this life of the things that God gives us, the relationships, the people, the stuff. And their memory is forgotten. Even the most significant people that have ever lived on this planet, who we think about maybe in history books, or we think about from time to time over just the course of our lives, for the most part, their memory is forgotten. Even that loved one who it was so crushing to see go. And maybe the tragic way that they left. after time passes, essentially in day-to-day life and everything that's going on, the memory of that person is forgotten. That's what he's saying. And all of the activities of their life, the love, the hate, the competitive spirit, the zeal, the relationships, the achievements, and all the causes they fought for, their enthusiasm, their drive, all of the opportunities that they had to glorify God in this life, Solomon says, are now gone. Death is sorrowful. That brings sorrow, that brings pain, that brings sadness. However, as you observe this fact, notice that Solomon is not teaching some sort of extinction theology. The words at the end of verse 6 make this abundantly clear. As it says, all that is done under the sun. That phrase in the book of Ecclesiastes indicates life on this earth. Solomon, in these verses, is not addressing the afterlife because that's not his main objective. Rather, he wants us to have the right perspective on this life right now that we are currently experiencing. This is why I wanted to bring this text this morning. It's about now. It's about thinking through life now. Those who die, Solomon says, will no longer have a share in all that is done under the sun. The idea share is helpfully defined by one commentator as the measure of joy and satisfaction that comes through one's daily activities, found not in self-centered pleasures, but only when taken as the gift of God. William Barrick, in his commentary on this text, wisely concludes, as Solomon does, that the wise person rightly understands that he or she only lives once. Once. Yeah, I think the last stanza of the poem by C.T. Studd, I mentioned this a couple weeks ago at the retreat, but it sums up the challenge to us as Christians from these verses quite sufficiently. Only one life, yes, only one. Now let me say, thy will be done. And when at last I'll hear the call, I'll know, I'll say, 'twas worth it all. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. This life, that's what Solomon's driving at. There are times to think about so many other things, but Solomon is directing our attention right now, as those of us sitting alive by God's kindness in this room, this is the gift that you've been given. What are you going to do? How you practically live out God's wisdom, or how do you practically live out God's wisdom regarding this truth? In the words of John Piper, the famous words of John Piper, don't waste your life. There's a second pertinent application of trusting God's wisdom, which we find in verses 7 through 9, and that is this: enjoy what he has specifically given to you. Enjoy what he has specifically given to you. The first specific items that God has given to you are found in verses 7 through 8, and we will simply call these material blessings. We saw this last time, verse 15. Chapter 8, so I'll just point them out briefly again now. But you see there, let your clothes be white all the time, or go then, eat your bread in happiness and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white all the time. Let not oil be lacking on your head. These material blessings from God that he has graciously given to us include, specifically in these verses, food and drink, that is, sustenance in order to survive the day. That reminds us to take care of the bodies that God has given us. Getting enough of the right kinds of food and drinks and the right amount of rest. Yes, sleep is necessary, friends. You are at an interesting stage of life. I was there. There was a period of my life where my schedule was sleeping from 12 a.m. to 4 a.m. And that doesn't go super awesome, not for an extended period of time, because God made us dependent creatures. And guess what? Despite what you may think at times, and trust me, I understand, I sympathize with you, but despite what you may think at times, sleep is a gift from God. And it is an absolutely necessary gift from God that you need to enjoy properly. He also mentions in these verses work. For God has already approved of your works. Work regardless of what you do. And maybe you're not in your career of choice at this moment. Appreciate as a gift from God to provide for your needs and for your wants. It's a gift. I look back on the path, you know, I mean, it's almost been 8 years, but I can still say, you know, with fullness of heart that this is the greatest job that God's ever given me. This is, I'm living the dream, and I love it. But I can trace back the path to get here. And the dream job wasn't those jobs. Some of them were good. Some of them were terrible. But the reality is God used every one of those segments of my life to provide. Not just what I needed, but often what I wanted. Work, Solomon says, is a gift. Appreciate it. Colossians 3, 23 and 24 says, whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of an inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. Regardless of the dead-end job that you think you might be in at this moment, you are not serving that employer who is terrible. You are serving Christ, who we just sang about, friends, is what? A good and gracious King. And as you serve him, as you apply yourself to serve him, there is an eternal reward that is being placed into your account every single day that you will one day experience, given to you from him. Work hard at your job. Work hard at your school assignments. Work hard at the daily mundane chores that you have to do to live. Work hard at whatever you have to do on a regular basis, constantly keeping in focus that your work is a gift from God who has given it to you, and that you need to aim to please him with your effort and your performance. There's another thing that Solomon mentions here we are to enjoy, and that is, in verse 8, comfort and celebration. This is what is meant by the language used in verse 8. It says, let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. The comforts of this life and the celebrations that you get to participate in, friends, are there for your enjoyment. Again, as I said last time, not there to be worshipped as idols, but to be received and enjoyed as gifts from God. This leads to a second specific item that we are given to enjoy, and we will call this marital bliss. Obviously, this could be a sermon all in of itself. Maybe you guys wish that was true. We only have a couple minutes. Look at verse 9. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun, for this is your reward in life and in your toil, in which you have labored under the sun. We're just going to spend the next few moments looking at seven wonderful truths this verse teaches us about marriage and the enjoyment marriage is to bring us in this life. And now I know you guys are in an interesting spot right now. Some of you, just all you can think about, I'm ready, Lord. Bring the person, show me the person. I mean, give me a vision. I don't care, Lord. Something, I'm ready to get married. Some of you are like, give me a minute. I need a minute, Lord. I'm not ready for that kind of commitment. But all of you, minus the very small, tiny percentage, which is less than 1%, I'm convinced, will probably be married in this life. And so these things are super important. They're important to think about in terms of what you want your marriage to look like. And they're super important for what you want your marriage to be one day. First of all, in verse 9, marriage is to be enjoyed. Enjoy life with the woman that you love all the days of your life. Enjoy life with the woman that you love. I love what Martin Luther said. He said, "Let the wife make the husband glad to come home, and let him make her sorry to see him leave." Life with the wife whom you love, or ladies, life with the husband that you love is to be enjoyed. It's not a ball and chain. Every, you know, image that the world gives you about what marriage is and how it ties you down, how it takes away all your freedom, is garbage. Marriage is given as a gift by God to be enjoyed. And I believe it is probably the greatest enjoyment two believers truly experience in this life apart from heaven. Marriage is to be enjoyed. Secondly, marriage is for companionship. It says, enjoy life with the woman whom you love. It says Genesis 2:18, isn't it? God said, it's not good for man to be alone for all kinds of reasons. And as a man who is alone, most of you in this room, you could probably exegete some of those reasons. But ultimately, what God is saying in Genesis chapter 2 is that loneliness is not the answer. Loneliness is not the goal. But companionship is the goal. And God created, as he says in Genesis 2:18, the perfect companion for man. And that is a wife. So marriage is for companionship. The companion is to be the one whom you share all of your dreams with, whom you share all of your issues with, whom you share all of your struggles with. This companionship is a deep, abiding friendship. In fact, your spouse should be your best friend on the planet. Solomon says, enjoy life with the woman whom you love. Third, marriage involves genuine love. Notice again. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love. Marriage involves genuine love. Listen, people are getting married for all kinds of weird reasons these days. And trying to marry weird things. Like the bizarre nature of our world right now. I saw an article. I saw this article. It wasn't a dream. And I wish I had not seen this article, but I saw it. I think for the new year, this woman, and she was in another country, she celebrated, she brought in the new year marrying her cat. Like, that's what she did. That's how people think. Like, that's how low people think about marriage. That is otherworldly. People get married to get into different countries. People get married to get their taxes on the same level, to save themselves some money. People get married because it's convenient. Man, you're always coming over here. Let's just get married, then we're here. We're here all the time. It's easier. People get married because they do things backwards. They have children together. And so now they're like, well, let's get married so that we can, you know, keep the family going. What does Solomon say? Solomon says, get married because you love that person. Get married because that person loves you. Marriage involves genuine love. Fourth, marriage is to be for life. What's it say? All the days of your fleeting life. All the days of your fleeting life. Marriage is not some optional contract that you enter into. It's not something that you're thinking how you're going to get out of it or if you're going to get out of it. That's not the perspective of marriage that Solomon brings to the table here. And it's certainly not backed up by the rest of Scripture. Marriage is entered into all the days of this life until one of the partners dies. The divorce scene on our planet is nuts. Divorcing for anything and everything. That is not on Solomon's mind. That is not what the Scriptures teach. Marriage is to be for life. Fifth, marriage is for this life. That's important. Marriage is for this life. He says, all the days of your fleeting life, which God has given you under the sun. Again, it is a gift. That is Solomon's context here. Remember, he's talking specifically about this life and making the most of this life. And so he says, marriage is for this life. You won't take your spouse into the next life. Jesus makes that clear when he's talking to the Pharisees and Sadducees. That there will not be marriage. People won't be given in marriage in heaven. But this life, because of God's kindness and because of the gift that he has created, he says, Solomon says, enjoy marriage for this life. Enjoy it every day. Number six, marriage is a gift from God. It says, which he has given you under the sun. Marriage is a gift. It's not a hassle. It's not a problem. It's not a drudgery. It's not a pain. It's a gift. It's a gift. Solomon says, enjoy it. Number seven, marriage is a reward. In verse 9, for this is your reward in life and in your toil which you have labored under the sun. If God graciously provides you a spouse, God is granting you a reward this side of heaven. Marriage is not a punishment. It's not a burden as our society so deems it. It's not something you try and run away from. It's not something you want to come home late to because you just are tired of it. It's not that. Marriage is a reward. The gracious reward that is meant for this life. What an incredible gift. Marriage is from the Lord. It can only be enjoyed the way that he intended it to be enjoyed if you go about it his way, which gives all kinds of prescriptions for. Friends, don't corrupt the sanctity of marriage in any way like the culture does. And maybe that's just in your thoughts. Don't do it. Don't dumb it down. Don't even say the word marriage in relationship to a woman doing that with a cat. Absurdity. It is God's greatest gift on this planet besides the gift of salvation. It is to be honored and held in high esteem by all. Simple application of what Solomon is saying here. Pursue marriage with a godly spouse. Yep, maximize your singleness. That needs to happen. You don't know how long you'll be single, so you maximize it every day. But friends, pursue marriage with a godly spouse. There are certainly many things we do not and cannot understand concerning God, concerning His ways, concerning His wisdom, but we are responsible to apply what we know. And God has graciously revealed to us truth, and He has given us all things to enjoy, and we are to apply that to our lives. We need to embrace this perspective wholeheartedly. And when you do, it'll change your life. When you have that right perspective, yes, eternity is waiting, but God has given me a life right now to maximize to the fullest. And you pursue living for Him fully by living according to what He has revealed, it will change your life. Your life won't be centered on the joy that comes from the things in this life. It'll be centered on the joy that is coming from God, that you're seeing everything as a gift. And that joy, that joy is impossible to remove. That joy is real. May God graciously continue to work in and through us by His Holy Spirit this year, applying His word regarding these specific truths to our lives for His glory and for our good. Let's pray. Lord, thanks for our time. I pray, Father, that our perspectives have been encouraged, that they have been challenged in some ways. Lord, that we will take this new year by the horns, so to speak, the good, the bad, and the ugly of it, everything that's going to come, all of the paradoxes that we might face and might observe, knowing that You are a good and gracious King, and Your wisdom supersedes our human limited wisdom, because Your wisdom is infinite. And in Your wisdom, and in Your goodness, in Your graciousness, Father, You have revealed to us in Your word everything we need for life and godliness. And these specific things that we looked at this morning, understanding these things, Lord, I pray that those will shape our perspective, and that as a result, our faith in You will grow. Our love for You will grow. And our desire to remain faithful until You come will grow. And we will, in turn, impact the world around us through that faithfulness and fruitfulness. We love You and praise You in Christ's name. Amen.